We're going to learn something today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. David Marquard wants to free the teachers. We'll ask how he proposes to do that. Then ask Garrison Keillor for the Writer's Almanac on Scribble.
Well, David, you hired my daughter for her first job at Rock Island High School.
But that's not precisely why he's on the program today.
Well, it's my reason why he's on the program today. She thought you were quite different from other superintendents she's used to. When you came into the classroom, you didn't pose with the children. You just said, "Sounds interesting, keep going." And so I'm predisposed to like you. And also, because you've written a book called Free the Teachers, and it's refreshing to find somebody who knows something about education writing a book about education. Usually, the further away from the classroom you are, the more you know about how it ought to be done.
I think the standard is you think back to your own education and think, what would I like improved from that, and then think that's the
right
answer, as if no time had intervened. What is the way to free the teachers, David?
Well, I think today our teachers are under, and administrators as well, but particularly teachers in the classroom, which is the crucible of education. That's where the real work is done and where learning takes place. And I think there are so many intervening things in their lives, such as testing, assessment, evaluation, that really rob them of the time they need to really get to know their students and be able to apply their craft in the way we may recall and the way we think that would be best for our kids.
You know, I've always been interested by the term education, educare, to lead out. You can't lay an education on someone. You have to lead it out. It has to come from them. And what's the trick? How do you do that?
I think your phrase kind of had me thinking about another phrase that you often hear, and that's covering the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And really what's happening sometimes, rather than covering the curriculum, we're covering students up with minutiae and things that really keep them from some real learning.
Well, how does that happen? I had a great high school education, and my kids, all of whom went to Rocky, I thought, had a good education too. But now I hear my daughter complain, of course, about assessment and tests. It's a rare week when there's a full week of school because there's so much else going on.
Don't you think it's because education is, in a way, kind of mysterious? You're not sure how it's done. And in this country, we want to quantify everything. We want to be sure that people are well-educated. Well, how do you know that? Well, I guess you set standards and make everyone reach it. But that doesn't sound to me like a good way to do it.
You know, it reminds me of when I was working on my dissertation at Illinois State, working with one of my stats professors, and he asked me why I did a particular statistical analysis. I really couldn't give him a great rationale other than because I could. It really didn't lead to any new learning or uncover anything about the problem we were looking at. And I think that's at least with some of the assessment that we do today. We do it because we can. It's easily quantifiable. But the true learning that results because of it, at least in some cases, is questionable. And I think the time that's committed both to the assessments in and of themselves, but also in some cases the preparation for those assessments, just takes us way far afield from real learning, which stems from questions. Mm-hmm. And if we can put full enriching questions in front of our students and provide guidance and some of the resources they need, I think we'll be on the way to freeing the teachers to do some of the things, and more importantly, freeing our students to have full and enriching learning experiences.
But it seems to me if you free, let me play the devil's advocate, if you free the teachers to be themselves in the classroom and teach joyfully the way they want to teach, they're all going to learn something different, you know, whereas the Common Core, which is one of the current phrases now, assures at least, you know, that testing that everybody will get the same questions and hopefully provide the same answers, more uniformity, or is that not so important?
You must have read the book already. because one of the things I talk about, in my early years of teaching, it really was, here's the grade book, here's the plan book, give you a key to your room, and good luck. So we had, it was kind of like the Wild West in some ways. I mean, we were all over the place. We had teachers teaching lots of things under the sun without any type of organization. So I think a key word, as it is with many things, is balance. The Common Core, and it is, I addressed the core in the book, in and of itself is not necessarily a culprit or a bad thing. When that becomes has a overly narrowing effect in how we approach instruction and becomes the finite content becomes the intent of instruction, then I think we lose some of the things that we need when we talk about 21st century skills. We want kids who are creative, can problem solve, can work together, those kinds of things. And the core in of itself doesn't prevent that, but I think if it's misinterpreted, we can get too tight of focus on content and not some of those other interactive things that in our real lives, that's the way we go about learning.
The whole purpose of education is to give you a background, a basis in number and letter, and enable you to think, give you a range of knowledge, appreciate something of the past and something of the present, and have you think your way into it. But I think the worry that many of us have is that maybe we are producing reliable consumers rather than independent thinkers. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm smiling because one of the reasons that I self-published or independently published the book was that after some conversations with some of the traditional educational publishers, it became clear to me, and again, this is addressed in the book as well, that the bottom line, driving the dollar, has become overly important in our society, and books and consultants and all those kinds of things. It's amazing how much money is spent in education for a plethora of things that may or may not be beneficial. So the driving the bottom line, I think, philosophy that has taken over, certainly it's been existent in private business, but seems to be replacing in some ways, common sense and more fulfilling things that don't really have to do with money. I think that's interwoven into some of what we see in our schools today.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the fact that when I went to school, we just went to school. You know, we had our lessons and so on with our homework and a test. But then after that, schools began teaching driver education. Then there was a thrust for business to get in and to have people come in the classroom and get kids worked up about free enterprise and starting their own business. And there are all kinds of interests that want the schools to do their particular work for them. And it seems to me the schools are getting overloaded. The dominance of athletics, there are all kinds of things that seem to me that might be interfering with the basic process of education.
Again, Don, you must have been looking inside that book because there are a few pages dedicated to that very idea. There was a person named, he's still around, so he still is, Jamie Vollmer, and he comes from the business world and was quite critical of schools not too many years ago. He happens to come from Iowa, until he started spending time in schools and seeing what was going on. And he provides a decade-by-decade look, starting back in about 1910, with all the initiatives that have come into the school, our schools. And I think it numbers something like 85 or 86 additional kinds of things for which schools are responsible that were never there when the common public school was first visualized and put into place. So, and one of the things is that school people do a pretty good job with those things. So when they take them on and do, you know, a great job or willing to do this, they remain in place. So that's something, looking at the complexity of the work that we have in schools, something that we call it pruning the tree, or I suggest pruning the tree. If you're going to add something, you better look at taking something out in its place. Otherwise, it becomes overly burdensome, and I think that's part of what our teachers face today.
What can you learn from all this, Roald?
Well, I think what David is saying, I have experienced. I taught 39 years of freshman English at Augustana College, and probably in those 25 years, we had 25 different books because at each spring we would say, "Well, this isn't working. Let's go to something else," and something else turned out not to work any better than the previous book.
There is no magic formula, is there?
Well, I mean, isn't that essentially what you're saying? Is that every teacher is different and every classroom has a different dynamic, and to make it all uniform just doesn't really work.
But then the worry becomes, do you really have an ace teacher in every class? And people are always, you know, how do you test teachers? How do you know you've got a good teacher? How do you know?
Yeah, those are good questions. I think parents who are involved with schools, when you sent your kids off to school, and if there were multiple sections of a third grade or fifth grade, those things become kind of common knowledge through the experiences and interactions with parents. You don't have to spend a long period of time in a classroom to figure out there's pretty effective, engaged instruction taking place. So some of it, and you know, I think that some of the standardized testing is helpful and helps advise us, but the way they're being used now in large degrees, they weren't even intended that way. If you talk to the authors of and creators of those assessments, they never intended them to be used in the evaluative way in which they are now. When we talk about, I think we can overly standardize things in a classroom, but there is good practice to be shared. So one of the things I did, particularly when I was working in the area of curriculum instruction, I visited many, many classrooms. So if in Don Wooten's class I see some things that are very valuable, I then became the courier to help share those with others. And we did come to an agreement in general about what content that we would center on and concentrate on, so we weren't all over the place. And part of that, you need, for instance, if you're the fifth grade teacher, you need some idea of, a pretty good idea of what they're doing in fourth grade and what the expectations are in sixth grade. So the system can work longitudinally as students move through it. So when I say free the teachers, as with everything, that's to a degree. I'm saying free them from some of the bureaucratic things that they're experiencing now, but encouraging them to work together to identify good common approaches in the classroom and solid ways to assess student performance. And yet within that, being able to make the daily decisions based on those very different kids you may have in your classroom.
One of the things I hear you say, though, is that it's possible to take a so-so teaching situation and turn it into a pretty good one.
And my experience has been that, for the most part, our teachers have a great want-to side. They want to do a good job. And that's been my experience with not all, but almost all teachers. And sometimes just giving them some insight, often it can be accomplished by having one teacher visit another teacher so they can actually see what's going on. But I think the idea of a person or a small select group of people have all of the answers gets us into a place where we don't want to be. And I say that from my own self-experience. Sometimes when I felt that I was more important or had more insight than I actually had, I found that was not the best approach with teachers. So certainly working collaboratively, sharing the good work, helping each other become better are ways that I think overall we can raise the bar. And I feel like the student who's coming into a test today, I had an answer, but I haven't seen the question yet. So I want to give you this answer.
Oh, good.
Because it was on my mind.
My question is, what is your answer?
There you go. A very good question. You can never go wrong with that one. About the time I was entering administration in 1983, A Nation at Risk came out, and it was a government requested report on the state of the schools in the nation. And it planted the seed at that time, maybe a whole bunch of seeds, that our public educational system was failing. At that time, the economy in Japan was doing very well, and we were encouraged to look to Japan for answers in their educational system and elsewhere. Well, here we are 30-plus years later, and I think for the most part, we have people who are well-educated. We have doctors, engineers, and so on. I think the longer we continue to kind of pound on public education, I was never one who responded to negative reinforcement. So I think if we can get back to a more positive approach with our schools, letting them know that a lot of the good things that we all experience in our lives, at least in some degree, has to do with the public education that's been provided for a lot of our kids, I think that's a healthier approach. And we can still be critical in a positive way about what we're doing and continue to try to improve. I'm in no way saying if we just go back to what we were doing 10 years ago, we'll be fine. But I do think that we've skipped over some things that have been effective. And in combination with seeking newer and better answers, I think that's a good place from which to operate.
What made you get into education, David?
A couple of things. One, I was playing football at Augustana College, and I wanted to stay involved with young people. And I was one of those kids who came to college, not like I have two children that are teachers, and they've wanted to teach since they were, you know, little bitty guys. So I came here not knowing what to do. And then I had an experience with a young guy who ended up teaching at Washington Junior High for many years in the science department. Had a tremendous influence on me when I was a sophomore, and I watched him and his student teaching and thought, you know, this is really something that I would like to do. And I've certainly had no regrets making the decision to go into education. I'd joyfully do it all over again. I always hasten to add, I hope I'd do a little better job as I went through it. But just the opportunity to interact with students. I love my content area, which was biology. I always try to encourage kids to look at life around them, what can be more important than their interaction with the environment and the actual workings of their own being. So combination of content and then a way to get after that in interacting with kids.
I knew you had something important to say. You're a fellow biologist. That's just wonderful. That was my field.
I didn't have the opportunity to come from Memphis, though. I
did. Yeah, well, it's not a bad place to be from, but I'm glad I came here. And glad you had the time to talk to us today, David. Free Teachers, Free the Teachers, A Guide to Joyful Teaching and Learning. I think it's something that you would enjoy reading and it would help you understand pretty much what goes on or what should go on in your schools. And you're right, public schools are the bedrock of this society. We really need you, and we want great success. Thank you very much for working for that success.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And now let's go to Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Book bag is up, and I see you digging into it.
I have the perfect book to follow David Marquardt's interview. I didn't want to ask him about cursive writing, but because he had more important things to worry about. There is a new book called The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting by Anne Trubeck, T-R-U-B-E-K. And lest you think that nothing is more boring than handwriting, read this book. It turns out that penmanship was born when the monks who copied manuscript after manuscript in the scriptoria in the Middle Ages were put out of work by the printing press. They had to have something to do, so they started going from town to town teaching penmanship. And particularly in the United States, in the middle of the 20th century, in the 1920s and 30s, there emerged two opposing schools of handwriting, the Spencer method by Platt Rogers Spencer and A.N. Palmer, which most of us studied, those little zeros that you go over and over and over. They had completely different theories. Spencer thought that you needed a flowing, billowing, exotic handwriting because you would be more elegant if you did. The Coca-Cola logo is Spencerian. Mm-hmm. The Palmer method was designed for secretaries to cut the nonsense and just write plainly and clearly, right? My mother was a Palmerian, not a Spencerian. But it turns out that both of these men thought that handwriting was not just handwriting. Here's Spencer writing, handwriting ennobles the soul. Quote, it refines our tastes, it assists in cultivating our judgment, and thereby makes us better men. And Palmer, the same thing. You, not only as your hand goes over the writing, but your spirit is going over it too, and you are being trained and refined and made more elegant by handwriting.
If that's the case, I'm the most inelegant person I know.
I'm getting much less elegant than I ever was. But it is really an interesting a book because it turns out there's a whole history and theory behind handwriting, and who knows what's going to happen. The uncertain future part of the title doesn't get much attention because there is going to be no handwriting shortly. But
it seems that
way. And that does bother me. I've thought about that, and nobody I talk to seems worried about it. Students don't seem worried. Mm-hmm. Teachers don't seem terribly worried.
We are captured by our machines. My mother had the most elegant handwriting, but all her letters slanted to the left. I'd never seen anyone do that because in the handwriting exercises we took, the letters kind of slanted to the right.
Yes.
But I guess that showed my mother had this individualistic streak, but it was beautiful handwriting, just beautiful.
Well, the Palmer method, do you even remember learning the Palmer method, which I'm sure you were taught in school? Here's the book. Students practiced arm movements alone for 3 to 6 weeks before even picking up a pen.
Yeah.
You got to get your hands going.
That's true. We had to go through those little exercises, and we had models to follow. But the name of the book again?
The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting.
Yeah, well, that's something to worry about now. But we're worried that you will be here next week when we'll be back with another session of Scribble.